Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American empire in 1000 B.C. when we come back. You know, in Job chapter 38, we read a scientific question in verse 34. It says, by what way is it that the light is parted? Or if we paraphrased it, by what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated? Now, can you imagine asking a question like that 4,000 years ago? Today, of course, it's a simple question to answer. And a student simply answers, well, by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known that 4,000 years ago in Job's day? And since it's manifestly impossible for any human mind to frame a question that the mind knows nothing of, it shows us that a greater mind than Job is the questioner here. Now, when we heat a metal red hot, or heat any substance until it's incandescent, it gives forth rays of light. These rays of light pass through the prism of a spectroscope, and they divide themselves on the graph according to the content of the matter that sent them forth. So when a ray of light reaches us from some far-flung star, all we have to do is pass that light ray through a spectroscope, and we can see what the composition of that star is. We can see each of its ingredients. Now, this division of light rays is always constant. It doesn't vary in the least particular. We may always rely upon the results. Spectroscopic analysis is an exact science. And this is the manner by which the light is apportioned or separated. Now, this places us in a quandary because either Job knew this, or a supernatural wisdom is being revealed here. And this is just one more of the many examples of science in the Bible. And this is one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first. Remember, that's free. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, and then just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about a book. We're reviewing a book here called The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. It's published by BibleBlessings.net, BibleBlessings.net, or you can write to them at Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. Again, that's Bible Blessings. That's the publisher. Their webpage is www.BibleBlessings.net. Their address is P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. The book written by Stephen Collins. Well, what began as an effort on the part of Assyria and its Mesopotamian allies to crush Israel's military power resulted in Israel becoming sovereign over all of the engaged Syrians and all of the Mesopotamian powers being put to flight. And the Assyrians and their allies learned firsthand that they could not defeat Israel's power. The battle occurred approximately 990 BC and was one of the most decisive battles in the history of either Israel or Assyria. And strangely, the aftermath of this epic battle between Israel and Assyria during King David's reign is not detailed in the Bible. Secular records, however, note the sudden decline of the Assyrian Empire during King David's reign, and contain logical inferences about what happened after this Israel victory over Assyria. Now, considering King David's warlike nature, it is inconceivable that he would have had a live-and-let-live attitude toward the Assyrians after their conspiracy to launch a surprise attack and to destroy David and his nation. Psalm 83, verse 8, confirms that King David realized that Assyria's key role in provoking the Ammonite rebellion and his attitude and that of the whole Israelite nation likely paralleled the American attitude of rage after the Japanese launched a sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. David's predictable action would be to launch a war of retribution against Assyria, and while the Bible does not record such an attack, secular records do. Now, historical accounts relate that although Assyria was very powerful under King Tiglath-Pileser, in the century prior to King David's rule, Assyrian power was broken and it became very weak during the reigns of Kings David and Solomon. It is this book's contention that Assyria's decline resulted from its defeat at the hands of King David. So let us examine evidence from secular history supporting this conclusion. Assyria possessed a large empire during the reign of Tiglath-Pileser I around 1100 BC. Assyria's military conquests included Mesopotamia, Syrian territory along the northern portions of the Euphrates River, and even northward into Armenia. Assyrian accounts of the reign of Tiglath-Pileser I state that his power extended to the Mediterranean Sea in the region of Arvad, a Phoenician city-state. It's further recorded that under Tiglath-Pileser and his long reign, about 1116 to 1078 BC, the Middle Assyrian Empire reached the height of its power, and yet the Great Assyrian Empire suddenly was prostrated during the reigns of Kings David and Solomon of Israel. Was this only a coincidence? This period of Assyrian weakness is described as follows. After the death of the great king Tiglath-Pileser I, his successors steadily lost ground before advancing Arameans under Ashur-Rabi II, about 1012 to 972. The Arameans drove the Assyrians from their ancient Euphrates frontier, and under his grandson, Tiglath-Pileser II, about 966 to 935, they advanced as far as the Tigris River, confining Syria to its narrowest recorded limits. Assyria was reduced to dire straits, and the poverty of its people is vividly described in the inscriptions of Ashur-Dan II, 934 to 912 BC, under whom the Assyrian Empire began its long climb back to its former greatness and former power. Now, the above dates are very significant because they confirm that Assyrian fortunes were inversely related to simultaneous events occurring in the ancient kingdom of Israel. The above account shows that Assyria was driven from the Euphrates River during the reign of King David. His reign was from 1010 to 970 BC. And this is the very time that the Bible states that David's army reached the Euphrates River and defeated a large Assyrian Mesopotamian army. Assyria is in dire straits and poverty during the reigns of King David and King Solomon, about 970 to 930 BC, when Israel's empire and power was at its zenith. Assyria did not recover until after a civil war divided the Israelites into separate rival kingdoms of Israel and Judah. It was toward the end of Ashur-Dan's II's reign over Assyria that Israel and Judah fought a costly civil war in which over 500,000 Israelite soldiers were killed. That's recorded in 2 Chronicles 13. And a long series of wars between the Israelite and the Jewish kingdom so depleted their mutual strengths that these two separate nations, Israel and Judah, which David had at one time united, were unable to throw off the Assyrian and Babylonian and Egyptian attacks which followed this civil war. And the above historical account cites Arameans as the force that conquered the Assyrian Empire during the reigns of David and Solomon. The Arameans are the Syrians of the Bible. However, the Bible asserts that King David defeated the Syrians and made them his servants. Now, how can the two accounts be reconciled? Well, there is an easy answer when we realize that the Syrian Arameans were Semites like the Israelites. They had descended from Aram, the son of Shem. You'll see that in Genesis 10, verses 21 and 22. Now, since the Syrians and the Israelites were racially similar, the Israelites who defeated the Arameans are known by the name of the territory through which they attacked Assyria. Since the Arameans became servants of David after their surrender to the Israelite army, they would have become David's vassals in King David's war against Assyria. Now, the Bible confirms the close racial link between the Israelites and the Arameans in Deuteronomy 26, verses 1 through 5, in which Israelites were to acknowledge that a wandering Aramean was my father. The racial bond between Israelites and Arameans is further confirmed by the fact that Rebekah, Isaac's wife, and Rachel and Leah, Jacob's wives, were from the Aramean region. Now, in addition, at least one Aramean ruler, King Toi of Hamath, was a willing ally of King David. You'll see that in 2 Samuel 8, verses 9 through 11. And since the Arameans became David's servants after their defeat at the hands of Israel, the Arameans themselves would not have gone to war with any nation without permission from King David. Secular records about Arameans invading the Assyrian Empire during King David's reign have missed the fact that the Arameans attacking from the west were King David's Israelites joined by Aramean vassal states. Because Israelites and Arameans were related Semitic people, the dominant Israelite role in this invasion has been overlooked by historians. Now, the Arameans also had a motive to join David's army in attacking Assyria. You see, Assyria was allied with the Arameans in the first battle against King David's army, but apparently retreated to Assyria before the second battle, abandoning the Arameans to fight the Israelites by themselves. So after being double-crossed by the Assyrians, the defeated Arameans could have become willing allies in King David's efforts against the Assyrians. Now, since 1 Chronicles 19:16 records that King David had defeated Arameans living east of the Euphrates River, King David's army was already fully mobilized and on Assyria's doorstep after he defeated the Arameans. And it's evident that King David invaded and conquered Assyria at the same time with help from his Aramean allies and vassals. Now, another account offers additional insight into the events of the time. The Encyclopedia Britannica tells us that an Assyrian revival culminated in the successful campaigns of Tiglath-Pileser about 1090 to 1060 BC. And this king was, however, actively engaged in repelling Aramean tribes, and from about 1050 to 950 BC, the invasion of Syria and northern Babylonia by his people, the Arameans, exhausted Babylonia and Assyria. Now, the biblical Syrians were the Arameans of the above account. The Encyclopedia Britannica acknowledges that Aramean territory was called Syria, and that they were a Semitic people. Harper's Bible Dictionary also refers to the biblical Syrians as Arameans. Therefore, it makes no sense to say that Arameans invaded Syria. They did not invade themselves. The fact that a major invasion of Syria and Mesopotamia occurred precisely during the reign of King David strongly supports the biblical account that King David's Israelites defeated the Arameans and the Assyrian Mesopotamian armies. The Encyclopedia Britannica account cited above notes that while Assyria had no difficulty defeating the Arameans prior to the reign of King David, the Arameans attacking from the west had sufficient power to exhaust Assyria and Babylon during David's reign. It is readily apparent that the Arameans, who invaded and exhausted Assyria and Mesopotamia, were King David's Israelites allied to the Semitic Arameans, who had become David's vassals during that time. And there's another reason why the Israelite role in the Aramean invasion of Assyria has been missed by major historians. The Hebrew and Aramaic languages were very closely related at the beginning of that time. Sabatino Mascati, in an introduction to the comparative grammar of the Semitic languages, categorizes Hebrew and Aramaic as Northwest Semitic languages and adds concerning Aramaic, quote, its earliest manifestation goes back to the beginning of the first millennium B.C. Harper's Bible Dictionary is more specific in stating that Aramaic, the language of the Arameans, was a Semitic language closely related to Hebrew, and it has been spoken in the Levant from the 9th century B.C. until the present. And it originated among the Arameans of northern Syria, said to be among the ancestors of Abraham, recorded in Genesis 28, verses 2 through 5. Now, the Hebrew and Aramaic languages were so closely linked during King David's reign that it would have been virtually impossible to linguistically distinguish between Israelites and Arameans in the army that invaded Mesopotamia during his reign. Indeed, the above account states that the Aramaic language was spoken in the region from the 9th century B.C. Now, this is quite significant, as the Arameans who defeated Assyria and Babylon did so in the 10th century B.C. About a century before, Aramaic can even be classified as a language distinct from Hebrew. Therefore, the Israelite and Aramean nations spoke a common Semitic language at the time that Assyria was defeated by Semitic armies invading from the west, in identifying Arameans as the invaders of Assyria during King David's reign. The term could just as easily be understood as Israelites speaking Hebrew. Affirming this fact that Israelites and Syrians spoke a common language, the Bible repeatedly records that Israelites and Arameans were able to converse with each other throughout biblical times. To conclude this point, the Israelites and Arameans were racially and linguistically similar during the 10th century B.C. because the Arameans had become the servants of King David when Assyria was invaded. The Aramean army invading Assyria in the 10th century B.C. was an Israelite army accompanied by Arameans. Secular history records that Assyria remained weak as long as the 12 tribes of Israel were united under Kings David and Solomon. The fact that Assyrian resurgence did not occur until after Israel's tribes divided back into their original two rival kingdoms supports the conclusion that it was Israel's power that had kept Assyria weak. Now, another overlooked factor in this balance of power between Israel and Assyria is the role of God Himself. When David and Solomon and the united tribes of Israel served God faithfully, obeying God and keeping His commandments, their power and empire was greatly expanded, as you'll see in 1 Chronicles 18, verse 6. One facet of Israel's covenant with God was that God would bless them with military victories when they were obedient, and would cause them to suffer military reverses if they disobeyed Him, as we see in Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 through 7, and Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 through 25. King Solomon eventually forsook God's laws, and the unity of the 12 tribes disintegrated soon after he died. Since God's promises were conditional on Israel's obedience, They lost God's favor after they forsook God's laws. And it was for this reason that the period of Israel's domination of Assyria was relatively brief. When King David's army conquered the Syrians, 2 Samuel 8 verse 4 records that the Israelites hamstrung all of the chariot horses but left enough for 100 chariots. When Israel defeated the Assyrians, David's army predictably would do the same to Assyria's horses. Now, earlier it was noted that the Assyrian king, Ashurdan II, led the Assyrian resurgence after Israel split into the rival kingdoms of Israel and Judah. Note what history has recorded was one of the first obstacles for this Assyrian king to overcome. It says, Ashurdan II and his son, Adad-nirari, 911 to 891 BC, were chiefly concerned with the restoration of Assyrian military power by procuring cavalry horses. And again, they struck back at the ring of Aramean tribes and states. Now, Assyria's severe shortage of military horses suitable for military service supports the conclusion that Israel was Assyria's conqueror, because the Bible records that it was an Israelite custom to maim their enemy's horses to render them useless for military applications. When Assyria reasserted itself, it struck against Aramean tribes. The Aramean tribes to the west of Assyria were the Israelite tribes and the Arameans once ruled by King David and Solomon. As Israel and Judah weakened each other, the Arameans also reasserted their independence from Israel, later becoming major enemies of Israel. And what is clearly evident in history is that as soon as Israel was weakened by civil war, the Assyrians were able to reassert themselves against the Arameans. This argues that the Aramean victories over the Assyrian Empire were never a result of strictly Aramean action. Indeed, if the Arameans had prevailed against Assyria without any help from Israel, Israel's civil war and division should have strengthened the Arameans against Assyria. A weakened Israel on their western flank would mean that they could direct even more power against Assyria. However, history records that once Israel's power collapsed, the power of the Arameans over Assyria also collapsed. And this confirms that the Semitic people who subjugated Assyria were mostly Israelites. Now, in an Israelite civil war, in approximately 913 B.C., the Israelite army lost 500,000 soldiers in one battle on one day against the army of Judah. Assuming Judah's losses were relatively small, in 2 Chronicles 13, 17, and 18, states that God favored Judah in that battle, and this battle wiped out almost half of Israel's military reserves. This drastically reduced Israel's power, and Assyria reasserted itself, and it was noted earlier that the Assyrian resurgence occurred in 911 to 891 BC, and it clearly shows the linkage between events in Israel and Assyria. Immediately after the costly Israelite civil war, Assyria began to rise and to assert its political and military power again. That Assyria attacked Israel so frequently in the time frame from 900 BC until the fall of Samaria in 721 BC argues that Assyria was wreaking vengeance to repay what Israel had done to them under King David. Assyria finally ended Israel's independence when Samaria fell, and would have done the same to Judah if it had not been for God's divine intervention to rescue Jerusalem from the Assyrians during Hezekiah's reign, recorded in 2 Kings 18 through 20. Now, the Assyrian determination to destroy Israel is consistent with the conclusion of this chapter, that Israel first conquered and humbled Assyria first. Now, after Assyria reasserted itself, it again began to write about its triumphs. Historian Zinaid Regazine notes that when Assyria's long spell of inactivity and obscurity, when it ended, they recorded detailed accounts of their victories in the time frame 900 to 666 BC, speaking of this period of time. Regazine notes, quote, that history of Assyria and that of the Jews are in constant collision. Almost every event connected with Assyria mentioned in the Bible is faithfully recorded in the historical inscriptions of the Assyrian kings. Regazine mistakenly applies the term Jews to both the Jewish kingdom of Judah and the non-Jewish kingdom of Israel, this observation highlights a contrast in the Assyrian records and the Israelite chronicles in the Bible. While Assyrian inscriptions proclaim their time of military ascendancy over Israel and Judah, they are totally silent about what happened during the time of Israelite domination. However, biblical accounts accurately describe both periods of time. Since the Bible's accounts are accurate about Israel's period of defeat and decline, when the normal human tendency is to gloss over or to omit negative events, it supports the conclusion that the Bible's accounts of Israel's victories and ascendancy reflect the same accuracy. And yet the kings of Israel and Judah during their mutual national declines were often wicked and deceitful men, and we cannot credit them for such remarkable truthfulness about their own wickedness and defeats. The fact that the biblical accounts have such accuracy, even about the times when human nature would ordinarily not want to be honest, argues that the Bible's accounts are inspired by divine authorship and not by self-serving humans. Now, secular history supports the biblical accounts of David's defeat of Assyria and Mesopotamia. The Bible has contained this record in 1 Chronicles 19 and Psalm 83 all along. But it has been overlooked. Worse, it's been ignored. And the racial and the linguistic affinities between Israelites and Arameans may account for the widespread lack of awareness of Israel's role in conquering Assyria during the reign of King David. However, human nature has a natural enemy. It's a natural enemy against God. You'll see that in Romans 8, verse 7, where it says that the carnal mind is enmity against God and isn't subject to the law of God, and neither indeed can be. And it obscures the true role of Israel in ancient history, and it makes it easier for mankind to ignore God's reality and the Bible's veracity. In addition, atheistic dogmas of humanism and evolution have created an academic environment that is openly hostile to the Bible, and their adherents are disinclined to find anything substantiating in the Bible. Now, in 2 Samuel 7, verse 9, it quotes God as telling David the following through the prophet Nathan. He said, quote, "I have been with you wherever you went, and I have cut off all of your enemies from before you, and I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth." Unquote. Now, God states that all, not just some, but all of David's enemies were cut off, and that David would become one of the most prominent and famous men on planet Earth. While David's name is still remembered today, modern man has not realized the true extent of King David's greatness, and God's promise was made prior to David's successful wars against the Arameans and the Assyrians. After David defeated the Arameans, Assyrians, and Mesopotamians, David was not merely the king of Israel and Judah, he was an emperor over many nations. He was the dominant monarch of his time, and Israel had become an ancient superpower. So it is worth noting here that the commanders of Israel's army at the time were two brothers, Joab and Abishai, and who were perhaps compatible to America's General Patton in World War II, as David was, he said that his commanders were too hard even for him. Now, 2 Samuel 3, verses 30 through 39, Joab and Abishai were very skilled in warfare, and while this was appropriate for a military expansionist time, they were to become anachronistic in Solomon's reign of peace. David, in fact, advised his son Solomon to kill Joab as soon as Solomon became king. You'll read that in 1 Kings 2, verses 5 and 6. Where had Joab and Abishai received their combative genes? Well, they were David's own nephews. You'll read that in 1 Chronicles 2, verses 13 through 16. Now, David had foreign troops who served as an ancient forerunner of Rome's Praetorian Guard. David's personal bodyguards consisted of 600 non-Israelites who were fiercely loyal to him. They followed him through both good and bad times and were called the Cherethites and the Pelethites in the Bible. 2 Samuel 15, verse 18 adds that David's bodyguards included Gittites from Gath, and David's armed bodyguards did not report to regular army commanders, but had their own commander who was responsible only to King David. Harper's Bible Dictionary observes that the Cherethites and Pelethites were likely descended from Cretans and Anatolians who had previously settled in the vicinity of the Philistines. Given the historic hostility between Israelites and Philistines, it's very remarkable that David's bodyguards included Gittites from Gath. Goliath, the giant whom David slew as a youth, had come from Gath. You'll see that in 1 Samuel 17, verse 23. Now, we don't know how these non-Israelites came to be so fiercely loyal to David, but it was a lifelong commitment on their part. Even when things looked very bleak for David during the revolt led by David's own son, Absalom, this foreign bodyguard remained absolutely loyal to David. You'll see that in 2 Samuel 15, verses 13 through 22. King David had at least one foreigner commanding part of his army. His name was Uriah the Hittite, and he had to be a very prominent Hittite in order to hold a high military rank in Israel's army, and also to have the honor of a residence located next to King David's palace, as you'll see in 2 Samuel 11, verses 2 through 4. The Hittites had formerly been a major power that had also fought the Assyrians, and Uriah may have risen to a high position in Israel's army by assisting King David's war against the Arameans and the Assyrians. Uriah was also the husband of Bathsheba, with whom David committed adultery. It was after Bathsheba became pregnant as a result of her affair with David that David managed to have Uriah killed in combat to cover his own sinful deed, as we see in 2 Samuel 11, verses 1 through 17. Now, this event shows that David's heart had strayed far from God and his laws at that time. However, when confronted about the sin by the prophet of God, David repented of this deed, as you see in 2 Samuel 12 and Psalm 51. And the Bible's discussion of David's scandal is typical of its even-handedness toward its heroes, as it records their sins and failings as well as their great deeds and their great accomplishments. Let me put a mark right here. We'll be back with more on Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American Empire, 1000 BC, when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour website is updated every week, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate by recommending or endorsing the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Tonight's program is from the book, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, Chapter 5, written by Stephen M. Collins. This is not pablum from the universities and evolutionary philosophy. This is strong meat that comes from the Bible, of all places, and secular history. The Bible and secular history. If you'd like to learn more about Stephen M. Collins, you can get more information from BibleBlessings.net. That's BibleBlessings.net. Or you can write to Bible Blessings, that's the publisher, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code 48068-1778. Again, that's Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. Now, here's a little special for you. I didn't check this out with the author here in advance, but he's endorsed or autographed all of the books that he sent to me. I guess you do that when you get somebody that wants to endorse or review your books. But he has done this in the past for listeners to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So why don't you call him direct at his home and tell him that you want a copy of his books. And he's written four, if you got a pen and paper. The one I'm reviewing now, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, Israel's Lost Empires, is a second book. And then The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found is a third book. And then Parthia, The Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History, are four books that I have on my desk. These are 1 in 100 books. You're not going to read anything anywhere like these. I think the closest that you could find would be something from Emmanuel Velikovsky with those wild, off-the-wall historical theories. Except that this guy, Collins, has documented what he's saying. I mean, I'm looking back here at the documentation, the index, persons, places, subjects, and the bibliography back here. I mean, it is pages and pages and pages of citations, including encyclopedias and all kinds of Bible helps and things like that. Collins. Let me look it up here. Collins. C-O-L-L-I-N-S. Stephen Collins is his name. Come on, Mr. Collins. Here he is. Number is 605-361-5069. That's area code 605-361-5069. You can call him right at home. Tell him you want that book autographed. Tell him you heard about it here on the Law Hour, an editorial review. You'd like to get an autographed copy. You can ask him how much he's going to charge. I sent him $100 and he sent me the five books. So that was $20 a book, autographed. They're worth 10 times that. You'll never find another book like Parthia, The Forgotten Ancient Superpower. Now, there's a couple of three books out on the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel found. For instance, J.H. Allen wrote a book called Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright. And Herbert Armstrong wrote a book on the United States and British Commonwealth and prophecy. There have been a few books on that order, but Collins leaves them all in the dust. I mean, there's documentation on top of documentation in The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found by Stephen Collins. That was the first book that I picked up. I don't know, somebody sent it to me or heard about it somewhere. That's oftentimes the way I find out about things. Some listener sends me a book or sends me a review, or he says, hey, you ought to look into this, and you do, and you find out that, hey, this is dynamite. All right, tonight's review, Israel's Rise to Greatness, the First British and American Empire, 1000 B.C., continues. The saga goes on. Listen to this. Now let's return to Israel's military situation after the battle with the Syrians, the Mesopotamians, and all of their allies. You see, many of the Phoenicians must have been watching the battle between Israel and the Assyrian-Syrian alliance with great trepidation, because an Israelite defeat would have meant Syrian-Assyrian rule over their city-states as well. Now, since David's psalm about this battle, remember that Psalm 83, mentions that the Phoenicians, such as Gebal and at least some inhabitants of Tyre, were cooperating with the Assyrian-Syrian group, there were some Assyrian sympathizers among the Phoenicians. So after the defeat of the rival alliance, the Israelite-Phoenician alliance became the world's foremost military power at that time. And Israel's military might, combined with the naval and commercial power of the Phoenician city-states, created an alliance which was both militarily and economically dominant over the rest of the world. Now, the Israelites and Jews as separate Hebrew people. You should understand that Jews and Israelites are not synonymous terms. Now, today, Jews call themselves Israelites and they have named their country Israel. And you presume that when you use the word Israelite, you're talking about a Jew, or a Jew is an Israelite. Now, it is true that all Jews are Israelites, but it is not true that all Israelites are Jews. For instance, all Californians are Americans, but not all Americans are Californians. So it's important to note that in biblical history, there are two separate nations with two separate dynasties of kings. They were separate before King David united them, and they were separate after the Civil War under Rehoboam. They are separate today, and except for the one brief period in history when David united Judah and Israel, Jews and Israelites have been separate nations in the same way that Americans and Australians are separate nations. We may be blood kin. We may have all originated from Great Britain. We may have all in our veins, we may all have English blood. But Australians are as different from Americans as Americans are from Canadians. We have separate national histories. We have separate national parliaments. We have separate national laws. We speak the same language, or at least we claim to speak English. I'll leave it up to you. If you believe that Australians speak English and that the English speak English, that's a conclusion for you to arrive at. I have a hard time understanding either one of them. I can understand the Canadians, but the Aussies and the British, they're a little tough. But they speak English in the same way that these Phoenicians, Arameans, and Israelites all spoke Hebrew or Aramaic. They could all understand each other. Well, kinda. Alright, so here's the Israelites and the Jew story. The separation of these two Israelite people. Some readers may have some skepticism about the Bible's assertion that Israel had an army of over 1.5 million men, and that Israel was involved in the great power struggles of the ancient world. To counter that skepticism, a very common misconception should be corrected right here. Most people assume that ancient Israel was comprised only of Jews, and therefore could not have been so populous. And most people make the common mistake of assuming the terms Israelite and Jew are synonymous terms when they are not. While King David was of the tribe of Judah, a Jew, only a minority of his nation and army was Jewish. The truth is that the nation of Israel was comprised of 12 tribes, with each tribe being composed of the descendants of one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Judah, from which the term Jew is derived, was only one of those 12 tribal units. In fact, the chief tribe of Israel was Joseph, and it was so blessed by God in numbers that it was subdivided into two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, and this actually resulted in 13 tribal units. Over the centuries, the populations of these tribes had grown so large that by the time of King David, they constituted a nation of considerable size, totally separate from Judah and the Jews. Now, the nation of Israel under David was composed of 13 distinct districts, one for each tribe. The tribe of Levi acted as a priestly tribe. Today, in America, we call these civil servants. And their geopolitical or geographical area consisted of 48 cities, as you'll see in Joshua chapter 21. These 48 cities were located throughout the nation, and Israel was therefore a constitutional monarchy, God's laws being their constitution, and as they rose to international prominence. However, the unity of these 13 tribes under David was an exception in their history, not the rule. The book of Judges catalogs the many tribal wars that the Israelites fought among themselves. The unity of the tribes brought about by King David lasted only a short time. Soon after the death of King David's son Solomon, Israel split into two nations totally hostile to each other. I'm going to break in right here and make a comment. In the book, The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found, Stephen Collins has identified 10 nations in the world today where those tribes are located. From memory, let me run through the list. South Africa, the tribe of Asher. England, the tribe of Ephraim. United States, as the tribe of Manasseh. The Danes, Denmark, the tribe of Dan is found in Denmark. And let's see, the Dutch. I'm going to say Naphtali, but that's not correct. I think Naphtali is in Sweden or Finland. And Benjamin is in Norway. And Simeon, I believe, is in Sweden. France is Reuben. I think Gad is in Switzerland and part of Germany. This book, The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found, uses the secular history of each one of those nations and simply traces it back to the Bible. Secular history traces back to the Bible. Queen Elizabeth is descended from this fellow that we're talking about now, King David. Queen Elizabeth, sitting on the throne of England today, is a descendant of David. So after Solomon's death, the northern 10 tribes led by Ephraim and Manasseh seceded from the Union and formed a new nation which possessed the majority of the population and retained Israel as its national name. You'll see that in 1 Kings 11, verses 28 through 36, and 1 Kings 12, verses 16 through 24. Now the southern two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin today is Norway. But Norway and Judah hung together with the tribe of Levi. As you'll read in 2 Chronicles 11 verses 12 through 14, and they retained the old capital city of Jerusalem, but adopted the new national name of Judah. Judah. The nation of Judah, the Jews, was never again known by the national name of Israel from that point on. Both of these kingdoms were Hebrew nations, but while Judah was Jewish, Israel was non-Jewish, and Israel and Judah were henceforth separate nations and fought many wars with each other in the same way that the United States of America separated from Great Britain and has a separate national history, and has fought at least two wars with England. Now, that's the way it is. Now, it is true, America and Britain are two brothers, two close nations. We're today fighting a war together in Iraq. We've done that throughout history. In World War II, we were united with the Danes, the Belgians, the Dutch, the French, the English. I mean, we were united with, we were working for, we were fighting the Nazis and the Japanese on behalf of these brother Israelite nations. But the Danes are a separate tribe, a separate nation with their own king, their own sovereign laws, national history, and their own language. And so are the Swedes and the Finns and the Norwegians and the Irish and the Scots and the Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders. You know, all of us are Israelites, but we're all separate tribes. And oftentimes we fight with one another over, you know, serious things, you know, like independence and money and trade and commerce and, you know, things that mean something, money. Now, Israel adopted idolatrous Baal worship, while Judah had periodic revivals in which they worshipped the God of Abraham. But by 721 BC, most of the Israelites were no longer in the Promised Land, having been driven from their land by the Assyrian invasions. The same Assyrians that King David had defeated rose up and came back and defeated the Israelites. And the kingdom of Judah, the Jews, continued in Palestine until approximately 587 BC, when they too were also removed from the land. And the descendants of Judah, because they retained the Sabbath day and many of the traditions and laws from the law of God, the Mosaic law, they retained their identity and they became known as Jews. Israel became known as the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel because they lost their identifying sign, which was the Sabbath day, the Sabbath sign. In large part because they abandoned customs that would have identified them as Hebrews and Israelites. Now, the books in this series on Israelite history will make it plainly evident that they were never lost at all. Their identity in the past was well known at times, particularly to some of the Jewish scholars. And when the modern nation of Israel was formed by the Jewish people in 1948, it was settled by the descendants and proselytes of the biblical nation of Judah. The national name of Israel was technically a biblical misnomer. If biblical precedent had been followed, the Jewish state in the Middle East today should have been named Judah. Most people do not realize that the Jews are not the only modern descendants of the ancient Israelites who were at one time ruled over by King David. After the division of the united 12-tribed kingdom under David and Solomon, the Jews ceased to be a part of that kingdom named Israel. From that point in time, the Jews of Judah and the Israelites of Israel had separate national histories, and to locate all of the modern descendants of the ancient nation ruled by King David, one would have to also locate all of the modern descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. So when the modern descendants of the ancient 10 tribes of Israel are in fact identified in Book 4 in this series on Israelite history, the reader will see that King David ruled over the forefathers of many modern nations. And you'll get that information in the book, The Lost 10 tribes of Israel Found. All modern descendants of the ancient tribes of Israel are Israelites in a racial sense, as all have descended from the one man, the patriarch Israel, whose original name was Jacob. You'll see that in Genesis 32, verse 28. However, in a national and prophetic sense, the term Israel does not apply to Jews from the time of the divided kingdom forward. And after that time, the Bible refers to Jews by the term Judah or House of Judah. The biblical term, and the Bible uses the term Israel or the House of Israel to refer to the descendants of the non-Jewish northern 10 tribes of Israel. Now, the above digression was lengthy, but it's very important. The biblically correct distinction between the terms Israel and Judah, or Jew, is an essential one to make early on in the history of the Israelite people, not only to understand the size of Israel in King David's time, but also to understand the rest of the subject material which will be presented in this book. Now, let's go back to our narrative, which we will take up next time. Let me give you a reminder here that we're reviewing the book titled The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. It's the story about Israel's rise to greatness. It is the story of the first British and American empire, about 1000 BC under King David. It is a fascinating story. It is the strong meat that the Bible speaks of rather than the milk of the Word. So if you're still on the milk of the Word, you need to go back to evolution and the university in Columbus discovered America. Now, if you want to get to some strong meat, then the book that you're looking for here is The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel by Stephen M. Collins. You can get a copy of it from the author himself. Let me give you his name and number just quickly here. Stephen M. Collins. Call this number, 605-361-5069. Again, that's 605-361-5069. Tell them little Georgie sent you. Please autograph the book. While you're at it, tell him you want all 5 books. You will never be satisfied with just one. Never. All right, we're about out of time. Let me give you a final reminder. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, with more on the origins and empire of ancient Israel. But you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and good night, friends.